All right, so John chapter 11, what has just happened is Jesus has once again pissed off the religious leaders by declaring his deity again, and they want to kill him. And so he's gone back up into the northern portions again to minister, up into, you know, basically where he's been most of the time, the upper areas of Israel. And let's just pick up the story in verse 1, and we'll talk about it. It's really cool. Verse 1, now a certain man was sick, Lazarus of Bethany, the town of Mary and her sister Martha. It was that Mary who anointed the Lord with fragrant oil and wiped his feet with her hair, whose brother Lazarus was sick. Therefore the sister sent to him, saying, Lord, behold, he whom you love is sick. This is a really cool family. I love this family. In fact, Mary of Bethany, I've said it before, is my absolute favorite character in the Bible, minus Jesus, obviously. But she is just absolutely fantastic. I love her. She's only mentioned in 3 stories, this being one of them. The other story she's mentioned in is Luke chapter 10. It's the first time Jesus kind of encounters these two women, and you guys probably all know it, right? Mary is sitting at the feet of Jesus, and Martha is working in the kitchen, right? And Martha rags on her sister, Lord, tell her to help me out. And Jesus actually compliments Mary. He says, man, she's doing the right thing. She's listening to my words. I'm what is really important. You know, I'm here. You need to be listening to me. You need to be receiving me. And that was the first time you meet him, and you see that Mary has this intimate connection with Christ. And in every story we're going to read about her, she has this beautiful vulnerability and this beautiful love for Jesus that always comes out in the stories that are told about her. And it's absolutely phenomenal. They lived in the area of Bethany, which is a town that's right next to Jerusalem. And so we're going to see the disciples are going to have a problem with that because the religious leaders want to kill him. And so they live in this area of Bethany, and so usually when Jesus would go down for the feast, he would hang out with Mary and Martha and Lazarus, and he would hang out with them. So he was very close to that family. He loved them very much. And now Lazarus, the brother, is sick. Now in verse 4 it says, when Jesus heard that, he said, this sickness is not unto death, but for the glory of God, that the Son of God may be glorified through it. Now Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus. So when he heard that he was sick, he stayed 2 more days in the place where he was. And this is a really interesting story because I'm sure you guys have read it before, where Lazarus, you know, spoiler alert, he dies, right? And Jesus raises him again. Really cool miracle that happens. And actually, it's the final miracle that John mentions inside of his gospel. He mentions 7 miracles. This is the 7th. This is the final one. And the interesting thing about that line is it says, Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus, so, in other words, because he loved them, he waited 2 days and let him die. Now, it's really interesting. You know, because Jesus loved them, he let Lazarus die. That's a weird sentence, because most of us would be like, well, because he loved them, shouldn't he save him, right? Isn't that the natural thing that we think of? And tonight, what we're going to be really focusing on is we're going to be focusing on Jesus in our grief, sadness, and pain. That's what we're going to be focusing on, Jesus and our grief, sadness, and pain, and how he answers that question of grief, sadness, and pain, how he fixes us. And in this story, like I said, the interesting thing is that Jesus allows grief, pain, and suffering to descend on this home. And he claims that the reason why he's doing it is because he loves them. That's a really interesting thing that I need to understand inside of my life, because the most tragic thing that's going to happen in your life and my life when grief and suffering happens inside of us, the first thing you're going to think is God is against me. He is not for me. And that's immediately what this family assumed as well. When their brother died, they assumed Jesus is not for us. Maybe he doesn't actually love us. And it's going to be difficult, as we talked about earlier in this book, when we talk about pain, when we talk about suffering, the answer that the Bible gives for pain and suffering is more complicated than any other book that we have. Right, most books that human beings have made, both philosophical and religious, have tried to simplify pain and suffering. They've said, this is the reason for pain and suffering, and it goes across the board. Christianity doesn't do that. Christianity says there's actually many reasons for pain and suffering. It's actually really complicated. And in fact, the full answer for why pain and suffering exists inside the Bible is never given. We've been given pieces of the answer that enable us to put our faith in God, but he never gives us the full answer, and the insinuation is that we can't take the full answer right now. We just can't understand it in the state that we're in, for whatever reason. But, again, the place that we have to trust is, I have to trust that whatever pain, whatever suffering that I'm going into, first of all, doesn't mean that Jesus doesn't love me. And secondly, it doesn't mean that he's forgotten about me. Jesus intentionally allows this to happen. Jesus is going to intentionally let pain and suffering happen inside your life. So that means, for the Christian, that means my pain and suffering must have a purpose or else God wouldn't allow it. And we'll talk about that more as we go through this. But we have to understand that our pain and suffering must have a purpose or else God would not allow it. Now let's go to verse 7. He says, "Then after this, he said to the disciples, 'Let us go to Judea again.' And the disciples said to him, 'Rabbi, lately the Jews sought to stone you, and you are going there again?' Jesus answered, 'Are there not 12 hours in the day? If anyone walks in the day, he does not stumble because he sees the light of the world. But if one walks in the night, he stumbles because the light is not in him.'" So here, Jesus is ending his earthly ministry. He knows he's about to die. So most of the things that he's going to say in the next coming chapters are going to be alluding to the fact that he knows his time is limited. And that's what he's saying. There's only 12 hours in the day. We're nearing night. Meaning what? Jesus said in John 8, "I am the light of the world." So what's he saying? I'm going to be taken out of this world soon, guys. You know, I need to do my work quickly because there's coming a time where I can't do it anymore. There's coming a time where it's going to be over. I'm going to be gone. I'm going to be taken away from you guys. And you need to understand that. Now, in verse 11, "These things he said, and after that he said to them, 'Our friend Lazarus sleeps, but I go that I may wake him up.' His disciples said, 'Lord, if he sleeps, he will get well.' However, Jesus spoke of his death, but they thought that he was speaking about taking rest and sleep. Then Jesus said to them plainly, 'Lazarus is dead, and I am glad for your sakes that I was not there, that you may believe. Nevertheless, let us go to him.' Then Thomas, who was called the twin, said to his fellow disciples, 'Let us also go, that we may die with him.'" So basically Thomas is just, he's the fatalist in the group, you know, doubting Thomas, right? He's always like the cynical one, you know, unless I see his hands and I put my hand in his side, then I'm not going to believe, right? He's the cynical one. And they're like, "Hey, let's go to Judea." And all the other ones are, "Oh, it's probably going to be okay, Thomas. Yeah, we're going to die. Yeah, we're going to die." You know, he's the cynic. And there's always got to be a cynic in a group. He makes things lively. You know, yeah, it's probably going to end terribly. You know, but let's go with him so we could die together. You know, at least that's the silver lining, guys. And you got to love Thomas. I love Thomas too. You know, for a lot of, and that Thomas as well. You know, but there's a lot of cool things about Thomas in the Bible. Another interesting thing that we're going to be talking about in a second is when the Bible talks about death, it always uses the word sleep. Multiple times in the Bible, in 1 Corinthians 15 and other letters of Paul, he says that those who are dead sleep in the earth. And in the Old Testament, it says the same thing. And that's because Jews of this time, they believed in something called the resurrection. It was prophesied first in the book of Job, actually, believe it or not, the oldest book that we have in the Bible. And it was mentioned again in the book of Daniel. And the promise that God gave his people is that there's going to be a life after death. Which is weird, right? Because most of us think life after death is heaven. But what the Bible was telling people is after you die, you go to an intermediate state. And then life after that life is when God actually raises your physical body up again and you live in the physical universe for all of eternity. You're going to be giving a new body that's going to exist and it's not going to decay and it's going to be the body that you always wanted you to have but you never had. Right? That's what resurrection means. So when Jesus is saying he sleeps, that's why he's using that language. He's saying that his body is asleep, but I'm going to go wake it up. I'm going to go raise him again. Right? Now, an interesting thing about this resurrection, because a lot of people would say, well, what's so special about Jesus' resurrection? Right? If Lazarus was raised from the dead, and Jesus actually, he raised a little girl from the dead in his earthly ministry as well. In fact, in the Old Testament, several people were raised from the dead. One of my favorite stories is there was a prophet named Elijah, anointed by the Spirit. He died, and they put him in a ditch. And someone just threw a random body in the ditch that Elijah was in, and it raised him from the dead. That must have been really weird. You know, he just lands like, oh my gosh, like I'm buried alive. Anyway, he got out of the ditch, and it was really cool. But the people in the Old Testament, people in the Bible have been raised from the dead tons of times. So people would be like, well, what's so special about Jesus' resurrection? Well, like I said, the Jews believed that when they said the word resurrection, that was life after death. That was the idea that I would have a new eternal body that would never decay, that would never fade away. When Lazarus was raised from the dead, guess what? He died again. He didn't receive a resurrection body. In fact, the way that we should refer to it, Lazarus wasn't resurrected, Lazarus was resuscitated. Essentially what Jesus did is he performed a miracle version of CPR and got him back up. But his body still had the same frailties that it had before he died, and he would die again. Jesus' resurrection is special because when he was raised, everyone understood that he is in a new body that will never die. He is in a new body that will never die, and that is unique to the Jewish belief system. And it's something that Christians have adopted because we pull our faith from Judaism. Now, in verse 17, it says this, "So when Jesus came, he found that he had already been in the tomb 4 days. Now, Bethany was near Jerusalem, about 2 miles away, and many of the Jews had joined the women around Martha and Mary to comfort them concerning their brother." Now, this is really cool. I love that Judaism does this. In Judaism, if something bad happened to you, a loss in your family or something like that, everything in your life stopped. You would shave your head, you would put on a sackcloth, you would throw ashes on yourself, and you would just cry for like a month. And actually, your friends, you would hire people called mourners, and they would come to your house, and their whole job was to cry with you. You would just wail, and you would mourn. And I think that's so radical. I think that's so awesome. Because sometimes when grief happens in my life, I just want to do that, but I know that the world keeps spinning. I still need to go back to my job. I still need to hang out with the same people, right? And I know that it's going to be awkward. We'll talk about that later. But I just think that it is cool that Judaism did that, that they had this like whole, like, you know, you just, oh, you know, you just cry and you'd wear like burlap, which is really itchy, to remind yourself that your life sucks. And then, you know, you do that for like, you do that for a whole month. And then that would be your mourning period. So that's what's happening. They're mourning right now for their brother. And in verse 20, it says, "Now Martha, as soon as she heard that Jesus was coming, went and met him. But Mary was sitting in the house. Now Martha said to Jesus, 'Lord, if you had only been here, my brother would not have died. But even now, I know that whatever you ask God, he will give you.' Jesus said to her, 'Your brother will rise again.' Martha said to him, 'I know that he will rise again in the resurrection at the last day.'" You see that faith? They believed that there would be a resurrection at the last day for all the saints who believed in God, right? The life after death. Verse 25, Jesus said to her, "I am the resurrection and the life. He who believes in me, though he may die, he will live." And that is the fifth I am statement that Jesus makes. It's the final miracle, fifth I am statement. I am the resurrection and the life. We'll talk a lot about that tonight. "Though he may die, he shall live. Whoever lives and believes in me shall never die. Do you believe this?" She said to him, "Yes, Lord. I believe that you are the Christ, the Son of God, who has come into the world." Verse 28. "And when he had said these things, she went her way and secretly called Mary, her sister, saying, 'The teacher has come and is calling for you.' As soon as she heard that, she arose quickly and came to him. Now Jesus had not yet come into the town, but was in the place where Martha met him. Then the Jews who were with her in the house and comforting her, when they saw that Mary rose up quickly and went out and followed her, saying, 'She is going to the tomb to weep there.' Then when Mary came there, came where Jesus was and saw him, she fell down at his feet, saying to him, 'Lord, if you had only been here, my brother would not have died.' Therefore, when Jesus saw her weeping and the Jews who came with her weeping, he groaned in the spirit and was troubled." Now, the word groaned, a lot of us think like, man, he was like really impassionate or really sad. It actually is the word for a snorting of an angry horse. It's the same word, which is really weird. So it's actually, he's not moved in a sad way. He is later. But in this moment, he's not moved in a sad way. He's moved in an angry way, which is kind of interesting. And we're going to talk about more about why he was moved in an angry way. But it says, and he was troubled. And the word for troubled is actually agitated, is the same word. If you ever have a washer and dryer, you know, and it has the agitate cycle, it's like, you know, shaking things up, you know, that's the idea of agitation, irritation, right? So get that idea in your head. He's angry. He's pissed. He's snorting like a horse or whatever, you know, and he's just like, he's angry. So, and the spirit was troubled. And he said, "Where have you laid him?" And he said to him, "Lord, come and see." Verse 35, Jesus wept. Then the Jews said, "See how he loved him." And some of them said, "Could not this man who opened the eyes of the blind also have kept this man from dying?" So this story is really important to us because like we've been talking about throughout the book of John, what John is doing is he's taking fundamental things to humanity, and he's showing how Jesus answers all of them. And this is one of the fundamental things that humanity has struggled with since our beginning, since our fall, should I say, something we've struggled with. And that is the idea of grief, pain, and suffering. How do we deal with it? And there's been many different ideologies that have come about throughout the years. I'm only going to talk about the two major ones today, And then we're going to talk about how Jesus deals with it and how he's different. But let's talk about the two major ones today. There's the letting it out method, and then there's the locking it up method. Letting it out and the locking it up. The letting it out method is the idea of when you're in pain and suffering, what you need to do is you need to surround yourself with a bunch of yes men, and you need to just let out your emotions. So meaning I just need to sit down with you guys. I need to say, I'm really sad. I'm really depressed. This has happened in my life. I need to express what's happened in my life in vivid detail. And your guys' job is simply to listen to me and say, that's all right. We understand. We love you. Just to affirm things to me. Right? That's the let it out method. I would say that's the more popular one in America today, the let it out method. You need to get it out, right? And it comes from the five stages of grieving. You guys have heard of that, right? The five stages of grieving. That's one of the stages. You need to let it out. You need to let people listen, and they need to comfort and console you. And that's how you do it. The second one is locking it up. Meaning if I'm feeling grief, if I'm feeling agitation, if I'm feeling sadness, what I need to do is I just need to act like it's not bothering me. So I do things to distract myself, you know, and I just act like nothing's wrong. And over time, those feelings will just go away, right? Over time, those things will just go away. That's the more stoic method, right? And I'm going to talk about the problems with each one, okay? Let's talk about the letting out method first, because I think it's the more common one. By the way, I did the locking up method, and it failed. But I'm going to talk about the letting out one. This is one that I've been introduced to in the last couple years of my life, meeting people who do this. Now, let's talk about the problems with that. Number one problem with the letting it out method is it makes you codependent on people. It makes you codependent on other people. So that means that if my whole way of dealing with grief and suffering is to let it out to people, that means that the only way I can deal with grief and suffering is if I'm letting it out to people. Now, what's the problem with putting your faith in people? Well, people are unreliable. You don't know if they're going to be there for you. You know, just because something bad happens in my life doesn't mean that everyone's going to drop what they're doing and come and console me. You know, what if something bad happens in my life, but in all my primary counselors, something's happening in their life too? What if they need to be counseled and consoled just as much as I do? You know, a major thing that happens that I've seen in my time in ministry is that married couples seem to do this to one another, where they become each other's consolation partners, where they let it out to one another. But here's the problem. What if something happens that equally impacts both of you? Now you don't have that rock. You don't have that support to lean on. So that's one big problem. Here's another big problem. People may not understand you. Okay, people may not understand you. So, for instance, I mean, people, and this is something that's going to happen in your own heart, but it's also going to be something that's going to be happening in them as well. Okay, because as people are comforting and consoling me, like let's say my dad died or something like that, and I'm sitting there and I'm just like, man, you know, it sucks. I'm never going to be able to hang out with him again. This is really terrible. And people, you guys come around me and say, hey, it's okay. We love you. We care for you. And in my heart, and you guys might say something like, we understand. And in my heart, I'm going to reject that. I'm going to say, you don't understand. You don't know what this is like. You don't know how I feel. You don't get it. Let me read you guys a proverb to illustrate this. This is Proverbs 14, verse 10. It says this. The heart knows its own bitterness, and a stranger does not share its joy. What the writer of Proverbs is saying is that ultimately only you know you. You know, and sometimes it could even frustrate us when we're doing the letting out method, because especially when you're in grief, when you're in suffering, when you're in mourning, you can't articulate things very well. So people might come up next to you and be like, hey, what's going on? And you're like, you know, this is what's going on. And it may come out way wrong. And they might be like, dude, you know, like that's wrong. And they might like start correcting you, like, no, that's not what I meant. You know, and it could go the wrong way. Right. Because ultimately, only you understand you. Your own heart understands its own bitterness. And no one can share in your joy. And the more you share with people, the more isolated you're going to feel. Because you're going to feel like, my support group doesn't understand me. They don't get it. It's going to leave you feeling more empty than you were before. And this is actually one of the major reasons why I read an article today from Time Magazine that they actually did a study, and they found out that the letting it out method fails far more than the holding it in method, which is kind of weird. Actually, people who hold it in tend to be more emotionally secure than people who let it out. And actually, they found out that some people who let it out remain depressed longer than the people who hold it in. which is really crazy. And I'll talk about the reasons of why that is. But this is one of them. This is one of them. If you're only dependent on yourself, then so what? You could hold it in and it's all good, right? You can't let yourself down too much. But if other people, if you feel that loneliness and isolation, when your only comfort comes from other people, then you're going to feel utterly desolate and without hope, right? It's going to destroy you. So that's another reason why relying on other people may not be the best idea. Here's another thing. They might get tired of you. In Job, it's interesting. His friends come to console him. You guys know the story of Job, right? You know, he loses everything. His friends come to console him. They wait for 7 days, and they don't say anything. Now, that's crazy to me. I'm like, dude, that's pretty intense. That's a lot of love there. But after 7 days, and Job's like, dude, I wish I was never born, they just launch into the guy because they're like, dude, it's been 7 days. Come on, bro. You know, your mourning period's over. Get up. Get over it. You know, like that's because people will understand. Everyone understands for like the first month that you're suffering. But after a month, people are like, hey, come on, man. All right, you need to get out of the house. You need to focus on your job. You know, you're letting things slide. It's time to get over this thing. Let's go eat. You know, let's go hang out. You know, come on, dude. You know, eventually people stop understanding. People don't get it. People don't understand why you're still hurting. And so they're going to be short with you. And beyond that, even if you don't have friends like that, in your heart you're always going to feel that way. Meaning, after a while of being comforted by other people, you're always going to think in your head, they must be getting sick of listening to my crap by now. And you're going to try to lock it up. So you're going to do this quasi letting it out, locking it up thing, and it's going to end up hurting you even more than just going full-blown one way. All right, so there's always that fear. Maybe people are sick of me. Maybe they don't want to hear it anymore. Or, you know, maybe they actually are sick of hearing it, and maybe they are actually letting you know that. You don't really know. But either way, obviously it's not a good solution. Next problem. The people I know who subscribe to the letting it out method tend to become very selfish. Here's what I mean. People who do the letting it out method, they constantly are just letting out how they feel entitled to share their feelings at all times whenever they feel like it. It almost comes across like this. I deserve to share how I feel, and you need to listen and comfort me. And when people aren't doing that for you, you'll automatically feel abandoned, and you're going to start thinking, you're a crappy friend, you suck, and you're going to start condemning them in your heart. Why? Because you're selfish. You see, this whole letting it out thing has made everything about you. It's pulled everything inwardly about your emotions. You become the center of attention. And a lot of times, it feeds our narcissism, meaning our need to be approved and validated by people. Right? So actually, some people, they struggle with letting go of depression, anxiety, fear, loneliness, guilt, all those things, because they realize, I only get attention when I'm hurting. People really seem to care about me when I'm hurting, but when everything's normal, people don't really seem to care about me too much. So I think I might just want to be in emotional collapses all the time. Right? And we've all met people like that, right? People who just like have to make everything about their emotions, right? No, you need to know how I feel. And it doesn't matter how you feel, you need to hear how I feel, you know? And even if something's going bad in your life, you're like, hey man, let me talk to you about this thing going on in my life. Well, let me talk to you about a thing going on in my life, you know? Like that, this is how I feel, right? You know, or you may even try to share grief with someone like that. Be like, hey man, like this happened in my life. And they'll be like, yeah, I know, man. Something like that happened in my life too, you know? And they'll make it all about them. Why? Because it's feeding their selfishness. It's feeding their insecurities and their need for validation in people. You see, it's making them codependent on people, which is bad. All right, here's the next thing that happens. It makes you blind to underlying problems in your life. So it means this. If all the time when I'm suffering with depression, pain, things like that, and I'm going and I'm telling you all the time, like, hey, dude, I'm hurting, and your only response to me is, hey, I understand, hey, I love you, hey, I support you, hey, you know, these things. What if there's something wrong with my heart and the way I'm perceiving things? What if I'm always going into emotional tizzies all the time? You know, what if it's no longer just the big things that are causing me to go to grief? What if I'm going into emotional collapses all the time? And every single time I go to someone and I share it with them, they're saying, hey, it's okay. We forgive you. We love you. We understand. And they're just affirming me, affirming me, affirming me, affirming me. They might be affirming me in sin. I might be doing sinful things, wrong things. I may be perceiving the world wrong, and because this culture thinks that you should never correct anyone, we feel like, no, I just need to validate them. No, I just need to affirm them. No, I just need... And really, all the while, you're affirming sin and you're affirming bad habits that are going to end up wrecking that person's emotional stability. Right? I always like the movie Inside Out by Pixar. You guys see that movie? It's awesome. It's a really good movie. Right? And you remember, Joy is kind of like that. Where Joy, the whole movie, it's about, you know, the girl's emotions, right? And she's going through depression. That's the whole point of the movie. The girl's going through depression, and it's kind of like what the emotions look like in that time. And Joy is kind of like that, where she always feels like whenever someone's sad, she just needs to pep them up. You know, she just needs to go like, hey, it's going to be great, and look at these, and let's be happy, you know? And it ends up making people even more depressed that are around her. Right? Because they're not actually, you know, you're not actually, again, sharing in their grief, and first off, and secondly, you're not getting to the underlying problems of why they're feeling the way they're feeling. You're not actually dealing with issues. Okay, so that's the problem with letting it out. Those are just some of the problems with letting it out. There are more, but those are just some. Here's the problems with holding it in. So this is what I do. I hold it in. So the benefits of holding it in that are better than letting it out is, once again, if you are your own counselor and your own comforter, you're not dependent on other people. Right? You're not dependent on other people. And so people who hold it in tend to actually be more emotionally secure than people who let it out. Meaning people who hold it in will usually be able to function pretty well when they're going through grief and pain and suffering. All right? They're actually able to function pretty well. But the way that we do it, the way that I do it, is when I start feeling pain, I start trying to deaden my pain nerves. Meaning I start feeling pain, I'm like, oh, I don't like this. So I just need to start deadening my emotions, right? So I don't feel bad anymore. I just don't want to feel bad. So I just try to, whenever I get a negative emotion, I shut it out. I say, no, it's not right. You know, I want to be happy. And that's why I said people who do this, you tend to distract yourself a lot. So once again, you could be doing this and not even realize it, but just ask yourself this question. When you become sad, what do? If you're a letting it out type person, you're immediately going to go to people. If you're a holding it in type person, you're gonna try to be alone, you're gonna isolate, and you're gonna try to distract yourself. And do you find yourself again trying to deaden your emotions? Then you probably do this method. This is probably what you do. Now here's the problems with that. First of all, it's gonna make you cold, cynical, and not be able to love. It's gonna make you down the line, it's gonna make you very cold, very cynical, and not able to love. Because the only way for you to do that is for you to just assume everything in my life could fade away, everything could die, and I need to be okay with that. So people who are like this tend to, in their minds, just think like, would I be okay if my dad died? Would I be okay if my mom died? And they always keep a distance between people because you're always afraid I might lose that person. Right? I might lose that person. People, by the way, who adopt this method of dealing with pain and grief usually are people who have had to deal with pain and grief at very young ages. At very young ages, they've had to deal with pain and grief, and so the way that they deal with loss is they just separate themselves emotionally. So they never allow themselves to get too close to people, because if I get too close to you and you leave me, I might get hurt. So I'm always going to keep a distance from you. So it makes you a little bit cold, makes you a little bit cynical. When I say cold and cynical, I mean that no matter what good thing is happening in your life, you're always going to assume it's going to end. So, you know, you could win the lottery and you'll just be like, you know, it's probably going to get taken away. You know, you can't really enjoy anything when you have this type of mentality. And that's how I was for a lot of years. No matter how many good things were happening inside of my life, I could never enjoy them because I always assumed that they were going to end. And I was trying to protect myself. All right, so that's another way, if you know that you do this method, is if you find it hard to enjoy things, to get excited about things, or to care about people. That's probably what you do. Another thing that does you is it makes you harsh. And incompassionate, meaning that when other people are suffering with grief and pain, the people who do this method will always look at you and be like, dude, just suck it up, you know, stop it, stop crying, what are you doing, you know, pick yourself up by your bootstraps, you know. In the Marine Corps, we always had the saying, I say it to some of you guys as a joke, I hope you guys know I'm joking, right, but they say, you know, just, hey, you really feeling some pain right now, why don't you go to Walgreens, aisle 9, get some straws and suck it up. All right. That was what they used to say to us. You know, and just no matter what's going on, you know, you could be shot, you could be anything, they just do, just suck it up. All right. Just walk it off, get over it. Right. That's like the whole, you know, cynical dad kind of thing. Walk it off, you know, no matter what's going on. So people who subscribe to this method will be very incompassionate to people
who are suffering, because all we've done our whole life is shut off our emotions and we just expect everyone else to do the same thing. So you're going to be a really terrible person to talk to and relate to other people. All right, so those are the negatives about that. And also, goes without saying, it makes you really selfish because you're usually only thinking about yourself. You don't even want to try to understand another person because you're just so focused on your own pain, your own suffering, and running away from that. So it makes you really selfish, makes you really cynical, makes you really harsh and really incompassionate. So those are kind of the problems that we have with those methods. So the thing that we struggle with as human beings is like, well, what other method could there be? Right? If I'm letting it out or if I'm holding it in and those don't work, what other method could there possibly be? Here's the answer to Christianity, and it's really interesting because it's illustrated in this story. Christianity's answer is actually the letting it out method is correct. It's just who you're letting it out to that matters. The letting it out method actually is the correct way to do it, but it's who you're letting it out to that makes all the difference in the world. If you let it out to a finite, fallen human being, then you can expect that level of care. But if you're letting it out to God, then you can expect infinitely more. And we'll talk about that more in a second. Here's the final problem with those two methods. Those two methods, first of all, cannot prevent depression, which we'll talk about, and they cannot protect you from intense suffering. Here's what I mean by that. There's a big difference between, say, me dating a girl, thinking that she's the one I want to marry, loving her intensely, and having her break up with me. That's suffering. That hurts. But it's way different for a parent to lose their 5-year-old kid to a school shooting. Does that make sense? They're both suffering, but one is way beyond the pale than the other. It's difficult for me if my parents who are in their 80s or 90s pass away. That's suffering. But it's far more intense for my 32-year-old sister to be a widow in the next year because her husband has cancer and to be left with 5 kids. See, it's suffering for, you know, let's say, once again, for me to move, to have to move from one area to another area, lose all my friends, lose all my family and everything like that. That's tough. That's suffering. It's something completely different when, let's say, during my first tour, when we accidentally gunned down 2 13-year-olds and their parents had to clean up their bodies. You see, that's a little different. These methods will not help with that. That level of suffering, these methods do not help with that. What the heck do you even say to somebody whose parents just, I mean, something like that just happened to them? What the heck am I going to say to my sister? Right? What am I going to say to my brother-in-law who's dying? Hey, buddy, I understand. I love you. I support you. You think that's going to matter? You see, there's a level of suffering that no amount of letting it out or holding it in is going to prevent you from slipping into what we call depression. It just doesn't work at a certain point. It just doesn't work. And again, the method I subscribed to was the holding it in method, but I'll tell you guys this, it didn't keep me from going into depression. In fact, sometimes the holding it in method adds to your depression. Because the thing that you start thinking about is you start thinking about if everything in my life is going to leave me and if I'm going to lose everything, including my own life one day, why care about anything and why be anything but sad? Your whole life becomes the tragedy as opposed to just select events. One of the great Stoic philosophers, when he was about to be carried off to be beheaded, his wife came up to him crying and he says, "Do not weep for the loss of my life. Weep for all the millions of losses you're going to have throughout your life." That's cheery, isn't it? Yeah, how could you not be depressed with a philosophy like that? Of course you're going to be depressed. So that level of intense suffering, you're never going to be able to do anything but be depressed. So let's talk about what depression is, because it is one of the number one things that afflicts people today. It's actually always afflicted people, except for we've just defined it now. People have always struggled to define what this thing is. People have defined depression as like intense grief or intense sadness. That's actually not depression. And because I always thought that's what depression was, I actually didn't know that I was depressed, ironically. I used to call it something different. I used to call it apathy, because that's what I thought it was. I thought that I just couldn't care about anything, and I thought that's what it was. Depression is actually, there's a this guy named Andrew Solomon, who studies depression, and here's how he defines it. He says, the opposite of depression is not happiness, but vitality. It was vitality that seemed to seep away from me in the moment of depression. Everything there was to do seemed like too much work. I would come home, and I would see the red light flashing on my answering machine. And instead of being thrilled to hear my friends, I would think, what a lot of people that I have to call back now. The Bible describes depression in a very interesting way. There actually is no Hebrew or Greek word for depression. The Bible actually just uses multiple words to describe what it is. And a lot of the Psalms actually describe depression. Psalm 42, Psalm 83. They describe they're people who are in the midst of depression, and they're explaining it in poetic ways. The way that the Bible explains depression is actually this phrase, broken spirit. That's what the Bible calls depression. And the spirit in the man, like what the spirit is, like if I say, hey, you're really spirited, what do I mean? You have a lot of energy, you have a lot of enthusiasm, you have a lot of life force in you, right? So if that's broken, what am I saying? Your actual vitality, your actual force, your energy, your ability to communicate, your ability to act has been taken from you. It's been stricken. And that's why depression feels this way. Depression, that's why I always used to describe it as apathy. Because when I was depressed, I found it hard to even emotionally care about anything. I found it difficult to get up in the morning. I found it difficult. And by the way, depression hits me every now and then still, even to this day. When I'm feeling depressed, I find it hard to care about anybody or anything, even myself. Sometimes when I'm depressed, I find it hard to eat or to sleep because it feels too difficult. See, that's what depression is. It's this horrific, horrific thing that plagues people more often than we could even imagine. And neither of these methods are going to help you with your depression. You could let it out all you want, and depression's still going to be at your door. You could hold it in all you want, and depression is still going to thrive in the darkness. You cannot stop depression with either of these two methods, which is why it's so crippling in our culture today. The only thing we really figured out to do with it is either wait out the storm, because some people who have depression will tell you it usually is a storm. It usually does lift after a while. Or you can medicate yourself. But there's really no other options. Either wait out the storm or you medicate yourself. You trick your body into feeling good even though that's not how you feel. But that obviously has its problems as well. Now, another thing that I'd like to say about depression is people who are depressed understand that their depression is ridiculous. Meaning when you're depressed, it's not like, you know, you're like, man, it's, you know, getting up would be so much work. That makes so much sense. You know, in your mind, you're like, why can't I sneak and get up? Why can't I care about things? Why? It almost frustrate you. You'll be like, why can't I care? Like, I know I love this person. Why can't I feel it right now? I know that I care about this job. Why can't I feel it? I know that. Does that make sense? You're always questioning, why can't I feel? Why can't I do these things? Because your depression is taking your vitality away from you, and you don't understand why. So depression infuriates you because you can't beat it. Another thing that separates depression from grief is the fact that grief is just a natural mourning process that we'll go through. And if you go through grief, eventually, no matter what method you subscribe to, it will eventually end. But that's why I said that those methods don't protect against depression, because depression creeps in during the grief. It's a terrible virus that comes into your life. So you may be like these other people who they get depressed because of grief. Grief leads them to depression. Or you might be like me, who are just biologically inclined to become depressed. Either way, eventually, you're going to have to deal with this. And like I said, neither of these two methods are going to help you in that moment, or in those series of moments if you're like me. Neither of those two methods are going to help you. I even got to the point where when I was 13, when I was an atheist and I was depressed, I wouldn't say I was suicidal, but I definitely thought that, you know, dying wouldn't be a big deal. Like if I died, I don't think it would matter too much. I think the only thing that kept me from committing suicide was the fact that it seemed like too much work. You know, it's just like, man, it's a lot of effort to actually kill myself and, you know, everything like that. There's a lot that goes into it. So your depression actually sucks away your vitality. You even want to end it all, even though you have nothing to live for. In the moment, that's what you think. You have nothing to live for. It's a really terrible thing. So let me read another passage to you guys. This is Proverbs 18, verse 14. Proverbs 18, verse 14 says this, "The spirit of a man will sustain him in sickness, but who can beat a broken spirit? Who could bear a broken spirit?" Meaning, even when intense grief happens to you, if you have a vitality in you, you could get through it. But if your vitality is robbed, it doesn't matter what situation you're going on that's going on in your life, you will not make it through. You will not make it through because your vitality has been stolen from you, because you're depressed, because you go through these problems. So let's talk about Jesus' solution, because this is such a huge problem. It's something that we're all going to have to wrestle with. What is Jesus' solution, and how is it better than these other methods? The first one I already kind of mentioned briefly. I said you need to let it out, but you need to let it out towards Christ. Now, why is it better to let it out towards Christ? First of all, Jesus understands you fully. Jesus is the only one who understands you fully. Every other person you let it out to is going to always be like, you know, they're going to try to understand you. In fact, if you and me went through the same exact tragedy at the same exact time, I still don't understand what you're going through. Because you're a complicated person, your emotions are complicated. I don't understand you fully. I don't understand you fully. Jesus is the only one who actually understands what you're going through fully. Second reason is his counsel is complete and perfect. So when someone's letting it out to me, like I said, sometimes when someone's letting it out to you, sometimes it's best just to sit and listen, and sometimes it's best to not say anything. It's illustrated by Jesus in this interaction. Did you guys catch it? Martha comes up to Jesus and she says, if you would have been here, my brother would not have died. She says, nevertheless, I know that whatever you ask of God, he will give it to you. So she expresses a little bit of faith at the end. And Jesus has to correct her a little bit. He says later, your brother will rise again. And then he says, I am the resurrection and the life. I mean, he's showing her something beautiful. He's showing her where her hope should be. And that was in him. Mary says the exact same thing. She comes up to him and she says, Lord, if you had only been here, my brother wouldn't have died. You know what Jesus does with her? He just cries. He doesn't say a word to her. He just cries. How did Jesus know to do that? See, if you and me would have been in that situation, we'd have been like, oh, okay, the theological answer worked with Martha. It must work with Mary. They've been going through the same thing. But you see, Jesus is smarter than you. And he knows when someone needs a word and when someone doesn't. That's, by the way, sometimes when people are pouring out their emotions before God, if he doesn't respond to you, don't think he's not counseling you. Sometimes his silence is a counsel. Sometimes his silence is a counsel. Sometimes his silence is just him showing you that he's with you. That's, you don't need an answer right now. You need him to be there for you. But other times you will need answers, and that's when he's going to give them to you. It's really interesting in the Bible to see the way that God counsels people. Jeremiah is my favorite one. Jeremiah was another depressed dude. He used to pray things like, oh, that my head were made out of water, that I could cry all day. I like that prayer. I'm like, man, I feel like that sometimes, dude. Sometimes I don't want to stop crying. You know, it's just like, dude, that sounds awesome. And sometimes, you know, when he freaked out, God would say things like, dude, I'm with you. Don't worry. They're not going to overcome you. I'm going to be like a wall, dude, that they can't climb over. I'm going to put my word in your mouth. It's going to be awesome. But then other times he's like, dude, if you're worn out running against people, dude, don't you know I've intended you to run against horses? Like, so we look at that, we're like, dude, that's kind of an intense way to counsel. But Jesus knew, God knew, that's what he needed in that moment. He didn't need affirmation. He needed me to say something. Other times when Jeremiah cries out to God, again, there's no answer. So you read how God comforts people, and you realize it's always different. Why? Because God understands grief and suffering are complicated, and you can't just give a blanket answer. And that's why he will always be a better counselor than human counselors. He is our wonderful counselor. Right? That's what he is. Now, the next thing that's important is he loves you unconditionally. No matter how great a human counselor is, like I said, eventually they're A, not going to understand you, and B, they're probably going to get tired of you after a time. And a lot of times, you got to also think, what is causing your grief? I haven't gone into it tonight because that's not what this passage is about, but many different things can cause your grief. Sometimes what's causing your grief is not someone dying, but sometimes what's causing your grief is maybe a sin. Maybe you feel bad because you really blew it. Maybe your grief is coming from guilt or shame. And how is a person going to cover over that? Hey, man, I forgive you. I love you. Well, that's great, but I still feel like junk. You know, like it doesn't work. right? The only way that you could feel that comfort is to know someone loves me unconditionally. Even when I'm being a total drag, God loves me, He wants me, He seeks me. Right? He loves me unconditionally. That's a wonderful thing to understand about Jesus. No one else loves you that way. No one else cares for you that way. Now, another thing that's really important is He provides perfect hope. Human beings, to get through a painful situation, we need hope. We need hope. Hope is the desire for something you haven't had yet. Okay, so for instance, if I say, I hope it rains tomorrow, what do I mean? I really desire for it to rain tomorrow. Hope will help. Hope is a necessary thing for getting through pain. For instance, if one of you had to get your wisdom teeth removed, it's a terribly painful process. But you understand that you have a hope that you hold on to that gets you through that process. If I don't do this, they're going to grow and the pain's going to be way worse, right? I'm going to have headaches. It's going to cause problems in my mouth, things like that. So that hope enables you to get through a painful process. Hopefully, if you don't have hope, you can't get through a process. That's what despair is, depression, despair. If you don't have a hope, you can't get through a process. And even worse, if you have a false hope, it's going to be even worse. And that's another problem with the Christian church, is sometimes we ply people with false hope. Someone's going through some grief or suffering. Hey, man, buck up, dude. It's going to get better. You don't know that. Don't say that. You know, don't say that. You don't know it's going to get better. You know, we ply people with false hope. Because if you say something like, hey, dude, it's going to get better, what happens when it doesn't? Right? Don't ply people with false hope. Jesus, the reason why His hope is so beautiful, I'll give you a couple reasons why Jesus' hope is better than any other hope you could ever have. First of all, it's transcendent. If your hope is in a physical thing, the physical thing could always be taken away from you, especially if you're going through a process of constant loss, right? Let's say, you know, my hope is in my family, and I just lost my dad. So I'm like, well, it's okay, I still got a job. But in the back of your mind, you'd be like, well, what happens if I lose that too? And that's what depressed people tend to do. Another way that you can understand if you're a depressed person, do you tend to overthink things? I mean, do you tend to sit down and just be like, man, like, you know, what if this happens? What if that happens? What if the other happens? We're all going to die soon. We're all going to do this. That's depression. That's depression talking. That's why you're doing that. It's a despair. It's a despair over your hope, over your plight, because you understand something. Hope that could be taken away is not a good hope to have. The Proverbs puts it this way. It says, hope deferred makes the heart sick. Hope that's taken away, hope that can be taken away, hope that's vulnerable, makes your heart sick, physically ill. Right? That's a problem. So your hope needs to be transcendent. Jesus is transcendent. He can't be taken away. He cannot be taken away. People could take away my life, they could take away my money, they could take away my career, they could take away my family, but they can never take away Christ. And it was that knowledge that allowed the Christians to go through the horrendous persecution that they went through in the first century. It was that knowledge that allowed Christians to watch their kids be mauled by lions and still praise God. Because their hope was transcendent. You see, if your hope is transcendent, it enables you to do crazy things like that. So first of all, He's transcendent. Secondly, the hope is personal. If your hope is impersonal, there's only so much you could do. Because deep down inside of all of us, our greatest hope is for love, acceptance, and validation. That's our greatest desire that we have as human beings. We want hope. We want love. We want people to care about us. We want that emotional connection with someone. So for me to say to someone, don't worry, you have hope in heaven, is a stupid hope. I have hope that I'm going to go to a cloudy place one day, because none of us understand what heaven is like. It's impersonal. Does that make sense? For me to say, hey, don't worry, you're going to go to heaven, how many Christians have actually been comforted with that? Oh, I'm going to go to a place in clouds one day. So it's totally cool that my daughter just died. Thanks, dude. You know, no one has ever truly been comforted by that fact. Hope has to be personal in order for it to get you through what you're going through. That's why Jesus says this. He corrects her. Remember how I said that? Verse 23, Jesus said to her, your brother will rise again. Martha said to him, I know that he will rise again in the resurrection at the last day. Jesus said to her, I am the resurrection. What's he saying? The resurrection is not about a place. The resurrection is about a person. It's about a relationship. It's about an eternal relationship. Isn't that the thing that we want most? A little bit ago, I quoted from J.R.R. Tolkien's essay on fairy stories, where he wrote an essay. It's really hard to read. If you ever try to read it, it's really hard to read, because like all things that Tolkien writes, It's difficult. All right, I'm just going to put it that way. It's difficult to get through. But the points that he makes are so awesome. And his major points inside of that essay was the reason why people are always, no matter what, they're always attracted to fairy stories. You know, and our literary critics have always been frustrated with this. Why are people going to see Disney more than they're going to see Shawshank Redemption? You know, what's going on? You know, why don't people have an appreciation for these really artsy, awesome movies? And his major point was that deep down, people want never-ending love. They want never-ending love, and they want to live in a world apart from the modern distractions. And that's what fairy tales enable you to have. That's why every fairy story ends with, and they lived happily ever after. It's that eternal, never-ending, never-parting love that attracts people. And what J.R.R. Tolkien's point was, is the reason why the Christian narrative is so appealing and hopeful is because it is a fairy story. It's the promise of love without parting. Eternal love without parting. No matter how much I love one of you, our love will part. Death will part our love one day. But the love of God never parts. It can't be taken away. So those are the reasons why Jesus' hope is so beautiful and wonderful. Now, the end of the story, I don't have time to read it, unfortunately. But Jesus, he stands outside of the tomb of Lazarus and he says, Lazarus, come forth, and Lazarus is raised. Right? He's resuscitated. Now, the question could be asked, why did Jesus do this? Here's another thing that has to be true about your hope. Your hope not only has to be all those things I said, but it also has to be realistic. It also has to be realistic, meaning it has to be believable. If you don't actually believe in your hope, it's of no value. You know, if one of you was like, hey, man, I just got fired. I was like, hey, dude, don't worry about it. You know, Steven Spielberg's looking for a new actor and his top film is coming out next year. You know, and you're a shoo-in. You know, that's hope, but it's so weird. It's so ethereal. It's so unbelievable that you would never actually put any stock in it. You'd be like, that's great. You know, thanks for that hope. You know, it's stupid. Your hope has to be realistic. So when Jesus is giving these people these hope, he understands something. Unless I make their hope realistic, it's not good hope. That's why he raised Lazarus from the dead. He had to prove that he had mastered death. He had to prove it. If your hope in Christ is not realistic, it's not going to be helpful to you. It's not going to be helpful to you at all. Meaning, if you don't know what you believe and why you believe it, that hope that you have in Christ, that fairy tale of, well, you know, I'm pretty sure I'll be with him one day, that's not going to help you when the poop hits the fan, man. When stuff really bad happens in your life, that weird, like, well, I think he's real, is not going to get you through the storm. It's just not going to. Your hope has to be realistic and believable in order for it to actually get you through what you're going through. Do you know why you believe that Jesus rose from the dead and that he is the resurrection and the life? Have you tasted and seen? And one of the major reasons why he walks you through suffering is to show you his faithfulness. So the question that I have to ask you guys is, have you taken up Jesus on his offer to be your wonderful counselor? Have you gone to him and have you suffered with him and seen that he comforts? And this is another thing that's true about Christianity. Christianity stands or falls on the truth of Jesus Christ. If what I'm telling you guys tonight isn't true, if Jesus isn't a real person, if he's not real, then everything I told you tonight is stupid. Because no amount of letting out your emotions to a fictional being is ever going to help you. The only way that Jesus can comfort you is if he's real. And I'll tell you, I've tried the Stoic method. I've tried to suppress my emotions. Never works. But I have tried to let my emotions out before God. And I'll tell you this, it does work. It's worked in ways I've never been able to experience before. The depression that I have now, I still experience it, but it's nothing like what I used to have. It's nothing like what I used to have. It's incredible the amount of victory that God's been giving me. It's unbelievable. And another thing I'll tell you about Jesus' hope that's so beautiful is Jesus understands. When I said he understands you, not only does he understand because he's in you and he knows you, but he understands you because he's gone through worse. I said that when Jesus, and he actually gets angry twice. It says he snorts, right, when he sees all the mourners and he's hanging around with Mary. It says he's like, you know, he just snorts like an angry horse. Later, when he sees Lazarus' body, he snorts again. Now, the reason for this anger, I think, is twofold. I think the first reason why he's angry is because Jesus is the creator of life, and seeing death is something that would offend the creator of life. So he's angry about that, for sure. When he sees the effects of death, it's something that makes him angry. Another important thing to understand as a Christian, don't go to a funeral and say, death is good. It's not good. Jesus didn't think it was good. You shouldn't think it's good. It's not good. It's the final enemy. It's horrible. Okay, so Jesus was pissed off about that, firstly. Secondly, remember, he weeps. He's angry. Notice what people said about him. Verse 37, and some of them said, could not this man who opened the eyes of the blind also have kept this man from dying? And both Mary and Martha said this exact same thing. People he cared for intimately said, Lord, if you would have been here, this wouldn't have happened. Underlying that question is, you don't care enough about us to prevent us from suffering. And the reason why Jesus is angry, the reason why he's upset, the reason why it brought him to tears was this. People could look at him and be like, Jesus, don't you care that this person died? And Jesus could easily look at them and say, don't you care that I died? Don't you care that I went through this? Don't you care that this has happened to me? You know, he could look right at those people's eyes and say, don't you care that I'm about to die? You know, here you are, and yes, it's sad, it's tragic, but you don't care at all about what happened to me, what I did for you. Jesus ultimately understands because he went through it first. That's why it's so important that we always focus on the cross. The cross has to hollow everything inside of our lives. That we're always looking to it. We're always thinking through it. That Jesus understands. That Jesus knows. There was a story in the Times that was released during the time of the Passion of the Christ. It was called, Why Did Jesus Have to Die? Now, the majority of the article is absolute garbage. But there's one part where, you know, because it's time, you know. But anyway, there's one part of the article where one of the women who they interviewed. So they interviewed a bunch of pastors, and you'll get the most theologically gobbledygook, jacked up thing of why Jesus had to die ever. But one of the women that they interviewed, they said, why does it matter that Jesus died for you? And she says, for me, it's not just about the atonement for my sins, but it's the fact that Jesus understands me. And she tells a story about when she was a little girl, she watched her mother get beaten to death by her boyfriend. And images of the blood-soaked mattress and her mom's bloody handprint on the wall of their living room haunted her whole life. And she said at the end, she said, now I know that Jesus knows what it's like to be beaten to death by someone he loved. And it's crazy. It enabled her to deal with her grief and suffering before Christ in a way that she couldn't with anyone else. See, who else are you going to tell that story to? And there's like a support group for that. You know, no one else is going to understand. Jesus understands. When you're going through grief and suffering, you need to express it to him. You need to seek out, how do I know that Jesus understands what I'm going through? Now, and I just want to end with this. I'm definitely not saying don't talk about it with other people. I'm not saying that. What I'm saying is don't be fully dependent on other people. When you're going through grief and suffering, be understanding. You know, because sometimes when you go through grief and suffering, you're going to get terrible advice. Just warning you. You're going to get terrible advice. You're going to get terrible counsel. People are not going to know how to comfort you. They're going to do wrong things. They're going to say wrong things. They're going to act wrong ways. And if your hope is in them, it's always going to be taken away from you. What I'm saying is it's good to share with people, because ultimately what Jesus is trying to do is he's trying to make us like him, that we would be wonderful counselors just like him. But none of us have made it yet. So that's why it's important to share our griefs with other people in the church. Paul put it this way in 2 Corinthians 1. He said, blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, the Father of all comforts, who comforts us in our tribulations that we might be able to comfort others with the same comfort that was given to us. So God does want to make you a wonderful counselor, and that's how it happens. But don't put your trust in people, because ultimately, like I said, they will let you down, but Jesus won't. Jesus understands. He knows, and he's going to get you through it. Let's pray. Dear God, I want to thank you so much for your word. I pray that it would impact us, that we would understand just what a wonderful counselor you are, just what a beautiful and wonderful Lord you are, that you did die for us. You did go through unbelievable hell for us, God, and because of that, you can understand us. You know where we're at. You know what we're going through. Help us to give all of our struggles and our worries to you, and help us to find comfort in you. In your name, amen.